Chapter 18. On the Marché. Our town, while being surrounded on all sides by more famous towns and chateaux, is renowned locally as having the best market in the area. In the UK, it would be called a farmer's market, so that prices could be upped accordingly, but here, it's just a market. Farmers, or at least artisans and producteurs, faithfully turn up every Thursday morning and take over the not inconsiderable town square, while people are bussed in from miles around for their weekly shop and social. And it is very much a social. As we headed into town in search of hens, the sun shone brightly and seemed more permanent than it had for months, less watery and with no chill in the air. Instead, there was a comfortable warmth and spring, which had clearly been hitting its own snooze button and just rolling over for the last few weeks, was now up, yawning, stretching and scratching its bits maybe, but it was up nonetheless, and the local community was waking up with it. The hardy souls who had braved the market throughout the winter were still there, but greeting each other anew, as if it were for the first time in months. Their numbers were swollen by the holiday home weekenders from Paris and the first wave of Loire tourists. The shops, which had stoically remained in business throughout the lean, almost deserted months, at last had customers again, although one or two had fallen by the wayside, simply unable to remain viable with so little custom. The old man who ran the alimentation had finally given up the ghost, as had the boucherie, though there were rumours that a new one would open soon. I love the individuality of the small-town French High Street. There are few big chains dominating, and there seems to be a desire to protect the tradition of High Street shopping. I had recently bought a Kindle, and I was still having problems with the whole e-reader thing. I'd been backed into buying one by the increasing vigilance of Ryanair and their refusal to allow a gram over their paltry 10 kilograms, and that the bag must conform to a certain size and shape. Really, they should just take over Weight Watchers. I like proper books and proper bookshops, and feel guilty about owning a Kindle because it's another, possibly last, nail in the coffin of the UK High Street where I had always bought my books. The traditional UK High Street has taken a battering. There are very few butchers left, virtually no ironmongers. Greg's counts barely as food, let alone as a bakery, and Waterstone's, the last bookshop, is hanging on by its fingernails. It's depressing. The British High Street has been left with estate agents, Wetherspoons, pubs, clothes shops, all selling the same designs, and McDonald's. Any individuality or small-scale entrepreneurship has been all but destroyed, trampled underfoot either by the internet, out-of-town shopping behemoths, or ridiculous car parking charges. As yet, in France, certainly rural France, this hasn't happened. The big supermarkets are there, obviously, but internet shopping is still largely distrusted, and small towns just don't charge for parking. In our town alone, there are 2 charcuteries, 4 boulangeries, no candlestick makers, but a quincaillerie, ironmongers, 2 florists, and 3 independent chemists, all serving a population of about 4,000. But that's not to say that the French should be complacent about hanging on to these things. The high streets of France have their own problems. The exodus from small rural towns to bigger conurbations continues as people quite rightly migrate in search of work, leaving villages and the like facing a tough future. There are other problems too. Whereas in England you might feel harassed on the streets by clusters of day-glow-vested charity muggers with their drama school enthusiasm. "Hi, you look great. Thought about third-world prostates?" Or intimidated by groups of school kids thinking that they're the first generation to try and wear the school tie in a rebellious fashion, France has a far more sinister group of street botherers, the old woman. They gather in groups, usually outside the chemist, and no one is safe from their unsolicited advice. So far, in the time I've lived here, I've been advised on what my child should not be wearing, my parking, the wisdom of sitting outside a bar when surely rain is imminent, food purchases, wine purchases, all purchases in fact, the speed I walk, smoking, not smoking, and the value of a solid forward defensive stroke. Okay, I made the last one up, but on one occasion when I pointed out to a group of old ladies that the child, my child, Terence to be exact, who they were declaring to be a pretty girl, was in fact a boy, they all paused for a second and then shook their heads in unison. "No," they said, "definitely a girl." They're a menace, like I say, and the one thing they haven't yet pulled me up on is what I'm wearing. They've obviously never seen a full-on mod before. They fall silent and begin crossing their chests. Another issue I have with the French high street is piped music, which is pumped into the streets almost daily through strategically placed speakers, but with no apparent thought whatsoever as to playlist. I don't mind the idea of it. As someone who wanders through life constantly with some soundtrack running through his head, I'd go as far as to say it's actually quite a nice idea. But if you're in rural France, think about what you're playing. This is the Loire Valley, so some classical baroque would be appropriate. The theme tune to Jean de Florette would work well in Provence. Musette would set a scene all over the country. You get the idea. What I don't want to hear as I stroll through a sleepy town is how some sociopath who hasn't yet managed to work out that jeans stay up with belts wants to gun his hose down or do this, that or the other to his bitch. Rap music may have done a brilliant job of highlighting racial tensions and domestic hardships in the bigger cities, but frankly, there are few styles of music less appropriate to French village life, except for maybe death/metal, or whatever it's called, which shouldn't be allowed anywhere, Scandinavia included. For once, though, the music seemed appropriate, and the busiest market day in months was bustling about its business to the silky sounds of Tino Rossi and Charles Trenet. There was a happy hum in the air as people wandered slowly through the lanes between stalls and refrigeration vans. In the winter, market shopping is more like a raid, as you know exactly what you're after and are unlikely to hang around to browse. The numerous boucherie and charcuterie vans had long queues. The cheese and saucisson stalls were all doing a roaring trade, each having their loyal and distinct followers. The vast and buxomly stocked fresh fish counters were gleaming, and the individual vignerons were giving away more freebies than they'd possibly have liked, but were happy to have the attention. This year, there were new sellers around too, a fresh pasta seller, a stuffed olive stall, and a ground spice man, and though always welcome, I feared they won't last the course. The market is a conservative place where traditional wares can thrive and have done for generations, but unlikely to support exotic interlopers in a sleepy rural backwater like this. Though, having said that, some of the most unlikely stalls return every spring, and for the life of me, I can't see how they survive. There's the African/West Indian stall, selling Bob Marley towels and dubious-looking cigarette paraphernalia, like this is Camden on a Sunday morning. There are the clothing stalls, which are ideal if you want your young daughter to dress like a streetwalker, or your son to look like he still hankers for that East 17 or New Kids on the Block look. And there are the shifty-looking watch sellers who constantly scour the crowds, hoping that whoever bought a cheap timepiece the week before won't be back looking for a refund. The same faces are there year in, year out, a comforting presence for the regulars. There's Ali, the gruff Moroccan fruit seller, who towards the end of the morning will start begrudgingly giving away rotten fruit and then moaning that we are taking money from the grandmother he has to support. Jean-Jacques, the ribald charcutier, whose risque jokes nearly always have a variant of pan au chocolat as the punchline. There's the depressed fisherman, the man who sells vegetable plants, and if he doesn't have what you want, he'll go and dig some up. There are successive generations of Romani selling baskets, salesmen who in the winter sell chauffage, central heating, and in the summer it's air conditioning. And there's the woman who owns a lingerie store, but who, in a tragic example of bad marketing, spends the entire morning adjusting her own obviously ill-fitting bra. And so, into this veritable hotbed of rural Frenchness, we strode, a family with a mission, hen-hunting. It's true that all of our other animals were rescued in one form or another, and although we were paying for these hens, there was a feeling that we were rescuing them too. There was one stall selling hens, cocks, geese, guinea fowl and ducks, and, even though it was outdoors, it reeked. Somehow, I was the only one who seemed to care enough to put his cravat over his nose. The woman in front of us wanted to choose three poules for Sunday dinner, as she had the whole family coming over, which is why we felt we were rescuing our birds, but she thankfully refrained from actually wringing their necks in front of us. She most certainly hadn't, unlike us, given them names. The stallholder roughly picked up Tallulah and Lola, hens chosen by Samuel and Morris, and shoved them in a cardboard box without ceremony, the poor, obviously startled birds hardly making a sound as they seemed resigned to their fate. Little did they know that after a short drive, they were about to reach animal paradise, where their every whim and foible would be catered for to the detriment of cohabiting human life. I had been resigned for some time to the extra responsibility, but had decided on a change of tack. If Natalie and the boys really were determined to build their own ark, then I had to somehow try to control its growth. Simply putting up objections hadn't worked at all, far from it. Like Prohibition, it had merely sent the whole farce underground, where it seemingly thrived. Take, for example, the issue of our recently acquired rabbit. I should have seen the signs when Morris had asked blithely at lunch a couple of weeks earlier, just after I had returned from a long trip abroad, "What shall we call the rabbit?" It never occurred to me that we had, while my back was turned, actually gained a rabbit. When Morris, who is innocent enough to be incapable of keeping a secret, asked about the potential naming of the rabbit, it just didn't register with me. I didn't notice the holding-the-breath silence or Morris reacting to being kicked under the table. I had prepared a sleeping draught in water the night before, but had miraculously fallen asleep before I could drink it. Unfortunately, when I woke up thirsty the next morning, it was the first thing I saw, and I downed it and spent the rest of the day in something of a fuzz. They could have had the rabbit on the dining table, and I'm not sure that I'd have noticed. I was in a vulnerable state, something which Junior took full advantage of. I had been dispatched to get the garden furniture from the loft above the stables, which meant shooing Junior and Ultim out of their stable and setting up a ladder to get into the loft. For once, I was able to move Junior relatively easily, and I locked him out, erected the ladder, and climbed into the loft. I went searching in the dim roof light for the hammock and the deck chairs, and returned to the top of the ladder to find Junior at the foot of it. I clearly had not locked the stable door. Junior looked up at me and, I swear, smiled as he sent the ladder crashing to the floor. I was stranded in the loft. It was too high to jump down, and anyway, Junior was in the way if I tried. So for 25 minutes I was calling out for rescue, which eventually came with lots of sympathy and concern. Not for me, you understand, but for Junior, in case he had been startled by the crash of the ladder, the poor dear. "He pushed it deliberately," I whined when I got down. "He bloody hates me, that horse does." "Go and have a lie down," they all said, guiding me back to the house. "Have a rest." "He did, though, deliberately." "Shush, shush, shush now. Go and have a nap." I should have known they were up to something. When I came back outside about an hour later, still a bit groggy but with more faculties than at any other time that day, I couldn't find anyone. I thought at first that they may have gone for a walk, but I could hear muffled voices coming from the wood store. Well, actually, not muffled, but muted, whispered, conspiratorial. Toby, who seemed to be standing guard, saw me and slinked off. I sneaked up to the door to try and hear what was going on, but couldn't quite make it out. Whatever it was, I was obviously to be kept out of it. "What's going on?" I demanded as I swung the door open. And there they were, the traitors, all four of them bending over a cage, shocked by my entrance and quickly shuffling into a line to block my view of whatever it was they were hiding. "What is it?" I asked. "What have you got now?" I wasn't angry, more resigned. Between the four of them, Terence punctuated their explanation with the word tractor, I got a picture of what had happened. They had found three baby rabbits, but unfortunately Vesper and Flame had found them at the same time, and now there was only one left. "We're trying to save it, Daddy," Samuel said. "It's all on its own now." "Yeah, well, I know how it feels," I responded, a touch dramatically. "So, let me get this straight. We're now rescuing animals from the clutches of the animals we've previously rescued, is that right?" They all looked at the floor like naughty schoolchildren, except for Terence, who said tractor. "We're going to release it back into the wild," Natalie began before I interrupted. "What, like the cats?" A killer blow to any logical person or argument, and therefore utterly useless in the face of these miscreants. "I'm all for rescuing animals. It's a good thing to do. But when you start effectively building your own domestic food chain, there's bound to be trouble. Toby, who is actually scared of the cat, has become a disappointment in his own right. He has an excess of growth hormone and has high cholesterol. He's like the Orson Welles of guard-dogging, a career that started off so promisingly has descended into mediocrity and obesity. The horses hate me. Piero disgusts everyone, and the cats are silent killers without remorse. Now we have a rabbit, presumably introduced just to destroy my vegetable patch. With all the secrecy, I felt it was one concession too many, and I was determined to be strong and draw a line somewhere, and this, without doubt, was it. As I was about to make this clear, Vespa sauntered into the wood store and dropped her latest victim, a lizard's tail. Just the tail. And it was angry. Lizard's tail, like headless chickens, can carry on for quite some time after being separated from the body, but this one was practically jumping. It was like the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, seemingly saying to Vespa, "Come on then, is that all you've got?" Vespa, bored, left the tail to it, which appeared to make it even more livid. We all just stared at this astonishing performance, unable to tear our eyes from the seething reptile body part. "Aw," said Morris eventually. "Can we keep it?" I realized there and then that resistance was utterly futile.